The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
All right, 51551, lots of texts coming in, but let's go straight to the UK and say a very good morning to our old friend Robert Harris. Good morning, Robert. Nice to have you on the show again.
Hi, Ryan. Nice to speak to you.
Okay, so where are you? Are you in the house, in the study, in the garden?
I'm in the study. Do I sound like I'm at the bottom of a mine shaft? I'm worried that I do.
It's not as beautiful as I would have hoped, but we'll if you keep nice and close to the microphone, I think is probably the key, and we'll see how we can survive.
Okay, sorry about this.
Not at all. You're in a bunker of sorts, so we'll forgive anything at this stage. And it's back to the bunkers we go. Will you give us the snapshot take on V2 for people who haven't read it yet?
Yes, it's a novel set at the end of November 1944, and it's about the German ballistic missile that they fired from the coast of occupied Holland at London. They fired 1,300 of these missiles, and it's about an engineer who helped devise the V2, who's working with the soldiers firing it on one side, and on the other side, a British woman who is sent out to occupied Belgium to try and stop the attacks. And the chapters of the novel alternate between the two of them.
And not only that, but it was in my imagination, Robert, or did the chapters get shorter as the excitement builds to the end? I mean, is that something you do purposely, or?
I did, yes, I suppose, because the action got quicker, so you had to keep going back and forth. It's kind of like a action counteraction novel. So yes, as it speeds up, so the chapters get shorter.
Here's what I took from the book in many ways, Robert, as somebody who's never lived through a war, who's never served in uniform, whose only knowledge or interest in it has come from books, movies, and so on. What I got was the V2 as a rocket, as a weapon, was terrifying. And in fact, war is terrifying. And that expression kept coming back to me, the pity of war. It is horrible. And yet the movies, the books, the history lend it a sort of anti-glamour.
I think that that's true. I think probably it's particularly true about the V2, which was such a technically sophisticated, astonishing tribute to man's ingenuity in a way, and the sheer power of it. It flew to a height of 60 miles into low space and hit London 200 miles away within 5 minutes, traveled at 3,500 miles an hour. I mean, it was an awesome weapon. And there is part of you, as you write about it, that you can't help but sort of think, my God, what an achievement it was to build such a thing in 1944.
Mm. And I'm sure you allude to it as the book proceeds, and particularly at the end. Wouldn't it be beautiful if something so horrific could have been built for something much more beautiful?
Well, and of course, in fairness to the rocket engineers who started out, and this is described in the novel, as a bunch of teenagers, idealistic teenagers, they really wanted to go to the moon and travel to the stars. But the only way that they could get the money to develop the rockets was through the government, and Hitler came to power in 1933. And immediately the German military were interested in the possibility of rockets as a weapon. So Wernher von Braun, who's a character in the book, he receives a massive amount of money from the Germans to develop the rocket. I don't think he ever lost his ultimate goal of putting a man on the moon, which, of course, in 1969 is what he did. The Saturn rocket that powered the Apollo moon program was based on the V2 technology.
Mm. So they were visionaries, but unfortunately got sidestepped by a madman.
Yes, well, it's the old joke by Mort Sahl. I aim at the stars, but occasionally I hit London. that was definitely true. It's also the case that Wernher von Braun sold the V2 to Hitler. That he flew to his headquarters after they made it work for the first time, showed him a film of it. And Hitler promptly ordered 10,000 of these rockets to be built to try and destroy London.
There's a kind of a really eerie moment that I think it's more than once it's described in the book, where they know it's kind of coming. They can feel it almost in the air. It's almost preternatural, and There's this kind of it's seconds that feel like time has gone into slow motion. Can you talk us through that, and how were you able to describe it so well?
Well, there are a few, you know, survivors' testimony about what it was like to be at the end of one of these things. And one thing that was quite common is that people said that just for a moment, it was as if all the air had been sucked away. Things went very still, and this was the rocket coming down twice the speed of sound, compressing the air, pushing it out of the way. And then, you know, you would hear the sonic boom as it broke the sound barrier, then the explosion as it blew up the building, and then the inrushing train-like noise of the rocket coming in. And so, you know, it was a very weird sound. And because of the acoustics of London, this noise or this double bang would echo right across London, maybe 7 or 8 times a day. If you can imagine the terror of that. And the ton of high explosive carried on the V2 would bury into the earth. And the force of the rocket coming in meant that the damage extended over a radius of about 1/4 mile. So although the V2 killed relatively few people, about 2,700 in London, which over 7 or 8 months is probably not that many, not as many as Hitler had hoped, it did huge damage and is said to have damaged about 600,000 buildings.
You've done something interesting as well in the book, Robert, among other things, which is to to bring women front and centre of the story. And in this case, Kay is our leading lady, if you want to call it that, based on, as you write in the notes, at the end, an obituary of a woman called Eileen Younghusband. And I suppose it's worth dwelling on that for a moment as to who they were. Were they kind of written, ghosted, if you like, by history for whatever reason? And why did you decide to go there? So there's 3 questions, I think, there, Robert, but in your own time.
I can take it. The book came out of reading an obituary in the Times newspaper 4 years ago of Eileen Younghusband, who died at the age of 95, who was one of 8 women Air Force officers who were flown from London to Belgium, newly liberated Belgium, in November 1944. They were put into a bank vault for security. They were issued with slide rules, pencils and paper, and their job was to calculate the curve of the V2. Because it was a ballistic missile, it followed what's called a parabolic curve. So, and if you have a bit of data, i.e. the radar picked up its track soon after it was launched, and then you knew the point of impact in London, with those 2 bits of data given to these women in the bank vault, they could work out the curve back to the point where the rocket had been launched. And this was crucial. If they could do it in 6 minutes, the rockets were launched from mobile trailers. This meant that it took them about 40 minutes to disassemble the site, that the RAF could get a Spitfire over these woods in about 30 minutes, and they could try and hit them before they were able to get away. So it was a sort of race against time. This was mentioned in this obituary, and I thought that would make a brilliant story. And the notion of these women, they were billeted on local families. There were lots of German sympathizers still around in Mechelen. It was a winter, freezing dark. I just thought that this would be a great story about women making a vital contribution to the war. And you're right, they are. It's a very unknown story. And you know, I've always wanted to write a novel with a woman playing that kind of crucial role in it. And this seemed to offer me the opportunity.
It's certainly, it grabs the attention at the very beginning when she's in a bed with a man with whom she shouldn't be with, nor he with her. And down comes the V2, and you thought, okay, well, that kicks off things pretty quickly. we're in here, no messing. You were in, obviously, you were in lockdown writing most, if not all, of this. So I was thinking of one of my favourite museums of them all in London, particularly, are the Churchill War Rooms. You know, it's stuffy and it's claustrophobic, but it reeks of history. Did you feel yourself bunkered down?
Yes, I did, really. I mean, normally what I do is write a novel between January and June. And I was going along merrily. I'd written about 1/4 of it when suddenly the pandemic hit. And, it seemed rather irrelevant to be writing a novel, especially perhaps a novel about the V2. And my normal rate of progress slowed to about 100 words a day. And you remember how certainly people I knew that they found their sleep rather disturbed and dreams were vivid.
Yep,
it was a difficult time to write, hard to concentrate. But after about 3 weeks, I thought, well, we're stuck with this. I mean, I'm at least going to try and come out at the end of it with a novel. And I think that the feeling of that time infects the book in a way, because there was a sort of wartime feel about it. There is still, in a way, that normal life has been upended. There is danger around. And we don't know how long it's going to take and how exactly we're going to come through it. And so I think, you know, that one senses how it might have been in the war a bit more now than one did before.
Were you watching the news last night or yesterday at all?
Probably through my fingers, yeah. Pressed to my eyes.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. I was watching Boris Johnson last night. Now, it can't help the fact that you have to socially distance on the green leather benches of the Parliament. But he doesn't look like himself. Now, I don't know if that's post-COVID. I don't know if that's the Dominic Cummings Richelieu effect. And I don't know whether he just isn't able for what we would call in Ireland senior hurling. What's happening with this man?
Well, I mean, one should say to begin with that this is a pretty grim for any leader to be faced with this situation.
Yeah.
And the pressure is relentless. Having said that, that's why they go in for it. They're supposed to be able to cope with it. And I just don't think it plays to his strengths. He's a naturally kind of upbeat and bullying character. And this is coming across as kind of snake oil salesmanship, really. And, you know, you alluded to Churchill. I mean, Churchill's method in the war was to lay it on thick how bad things were. You know, this is going to be a long, hard struggle. I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweat. You know, he didn't try and sugarcoat it and say we're going to have a world-beating track and trace and all of this. And I think that he was quite seriously ill with it. And I don't think his personal circumstances, his divorce and so on, I think that's probably been pretty traumatic as well. I think he is in a bit of a bad place, to be frank.
Is he able for leadership at this level, at this time in your country's history and the world's history?
I think that he's an entertainer, really, both as a columnist and appearing on television. Have I got news for you? And so on. That was his natural métier, and a figurehead. A man who comes around to cheer you all up and puts on funny hats and things. I mean, he's not clever, but that was his shtick. And we're in a time when we need the very opposite of that, actually. The leaders that have done best, Angela Merkel, obviously, scientific background, slightly dull, but knows how to run a government. I think too much of the actual drive of the government and its strategy is devolved upon Dominic Cummings, his advisor.
Yeah.
And he's sort of unsackable, because if you took him away, he seems to be like the president's brain, in the words of a film in the 60s, you know?
Yes.
So it's an unhappy state of affairs, to be absolutely honest, to add to all the other problems.
It always baffles me how Johnson is so mad about Churchill and comparing himself in the most unlikely manner to the wartime leader that we've been discussing. But I want to go back to a point you just made there, which was that Churchill was able to tell your people that this is bad. And Roosevelt, as we know, FDR said, with nothing to fear but fear itself, but also called on them and said, we need to rally because this is bad. Do leaders, particularly nowadays, I think sometimes they underestimate the intelligence sometimes of the electorate to take on bad news as long as they're led well.
I agree. And also there is a desire to come together and to get on with it together. There was a huge wave of support and sympathy for Johnson to begin with, and which seems to be dissipating. Because you're getting tired of hearing the same old kind of optimistic rubbish, to put it more politely than I might do if we were in a pub.
Indeed.
And so, you know, the difference between Churchill and Johnson is day and night, really. I mean, Churchill, whatever his enemies thought of him, they all acknowledged he worked tremendously hard. He was an absolutely dominant figure, detail, and strategy and tactics, and a profoundly serious man beneath the kind of wit and jokey public image. One feels with Johnson there isn't a profoundly serious man beneath it, that he likes the trappings of it, likes being it, but he doesn't really relish the decision-making and the power. And, you know, it's unfortunate, to put it mildly, that he's collided with this particular time. And we're not even talking about Brexit, are we?
So, no, we're not. Not, yeah, not this. I mean,
this is a storm-lashed island,
isn't it? Though I mean, and to try and dismantle an international treaty, and so publicly, and so it beggars belief. You know, we are looking aghast at what's happening at the UK.
Yes, well, I think a lot of people here are too, and a lot of people. I was just happening to read, before I started talking to you, the Spectator magazine this week, which has a very long attack on their own former boss, their own former editor.
Yes.
Where's Boris? You know.
Yes.
So it spread from his, from people who were always sceptical about Boris, and myself included, to the very people who were who were his closest supporters. It's, you know, there's just a sense of flopping around, really, and hubris.
Well, you know, a beautiful word, and not quite ancient Roman or Latin, but when you think of the Cicero trilogy, I would love to know what Cicero would think, watching what's happening in Washington DC and beyond, and talk about leadership and not telling the truth to the people, as we now know from the Woodward tapes. An extraordinary figurehead there. And again, a leadership deficit like no other.
Yeah, you know, these were leaders elected in a completely different world. In his way, Johnson is a bit like Neville Chamberlain. You know, he was fine for one period, but he's wrong for this one. Whatever his qualities, you know, this isn't good. And the same with Trump. You know, they were elected partly to raise two fingers to the establishment, the elite. This is very like ancient Rome and Cicero, you know, when the mob was whipped up against the Senate. It feels the same. And when something comes along like a pandemic or major international crisis, you find yourself with people who are anti-elite. They are, you know, propagandists and populists, but they don't necessarily know how to run anything. And how to rally a whole country, not just, you know, whip up their own particular supporters. So, you know, it's a great misfortune for the British and the Americans that they found themselves with these particular leaders at this particular time.
Yeah, I think we're unfortunate that sometimes, politically speaking, to use the analogy, sometimes the dogs actually catch the car.
Yeah, not with promising results. Either.
Correct. Robert, congratulations on V2. Obviously, look forward to meeting you in the flesh in due course. But in the meantime, thanks for giving us another joy of a read. And we wish you well. And we'll talk soon, I hope.
Thank you. Goodbye from the mine shaft.
Yeah. Goodbye. Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf
Wiedersehen. As Robert,
we'll meet again.
We'll be sure. I should have had Dame Vera's song ready to go there. We'll meet again is right. Robert Harris, always a joy. Gosh, I love talking to Robert. V2 is the book. I saw it in the bookshops yesterday, so it's shiny and new and ready for your delectation. So go grab it and enjoy. More for you after this.